Good morning, Santa Fe. Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Tony Stromberg. He is a photographer whose new book is called The Forgotten Horses. Right now, I'd like to welcome some very special guests. Three Tibetan monks join us, Venerable Tenzin Phensuk, Geshe Tsulak Gyatso, and Venerable Nawang Jimpa, and Marcia Keegan, who is a photographer and publisher of Clear Light Books. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So you are from the Drepung Losaling Monastery. Tell us about this monastery. It's almost 600 years old.
So Drepung Losaling Monastery was one of the largest monastery in Tibet and was founded in 1416 in Tibet. And it used to have, you know, the over 10,000 student monks at the monastic universities. And after invasion and occupation by Chinese communists, you know, the military, in 1959, so it was out of, you know, the over 10,000 student monks, only 216 surviving monks could escape from that Holocaust and arrive at India as a political asylum, you know, the refugee. And then thereby they established the refugee monastery in 1960s in southern India. So we are from, you know, the refugee monastery from South India. So right now it houses over 3,000 monks.
And all the rest of the monks were actually killed in Tibet?
Yes. In 1959 itself, you know, the 1.2 million Tibetan people were killed by the Chinese communists, you know, the party who, you know, they occupied Tibet. So in 1959, over 1.2 million Tibetan people were killed, and 6,500 monasteries was totally destroyed.
Now, this is you're in southern India, so you're not near the Tibetan community in Dharamsala.
So we are not, you know, we are from the South India. So these days, you know, the majority people in, you know, the Tibetan refugee people are settled in South India. I could say, you know, there are the five major, you know, the Tibetan refugee settlements. So we are from the, you know, the Mongot Tibetan refugee settlements, where we have over, you know, the 20,000 people, refugee Tibetan people there. And also next to, you know, the Mongot Tibetan refugee settlements, and there's and Mysore, you know, the Tibetan refugee settlements. So they're all over, you know, within, you know, the South India, there are, you know, the five major Tibetan refugee settlements there. So I could say, you know, the majority, you know, the Tibetan, you know, the refugee people are located within South India. And also the Tibetans, the refugee, the exile, you know, the government, the headquarters, and also His Holiness Dalai Lama's residence, also, you know, the located in the, in the northern India, where the Dalai Lama's, you know, live there in, you know, the Dharamsalas, and all the offices and the departments of, you know, the exile governments, you know, located in Dharamsala.
So, what is the monastery like now? Did the people who built it in southern India try to replicate it to make it look like the one in Tibet?
Exactly. So when they, you know, the people, when, like, for example, you know, the His Holiness came into, you know, the exile in 1959, along with over, you know, the 100,000 Tibetan people, you know, with His Holiness in that, you know, the 1959. First day, you know, settled in the northern India, like Dharamsala and Mussoorie. So Mussoorie is actually the first site of, you know, the exile government, you know, the offices and all those things. And in 1960, I think 61 or 2, you know, then they moved to Dharamsala, all the offices, headquarters of the Tibetan exile government. And thereby, you know, because of the increasing, you know, the population, the refugee Tibetan people from, you know, from Tibet. So then somehow, you know, it got to split from the, you know, the northern India to South India. And also many of the South Indians, the governors and the governments, they, you know, they offer the land, the piece of land for the Tibetan refugee people. And then so that's how they After that, you know, then many Tibetan refugee people, you know, they moved to southern India. And when they arrived there, so as for the, our monastery, we only have, you know, the 216 surviving monks who escaped from that, you know, in the Holocaust in 1959. And then thereby they first arrived there and there was nothing. That's just, you know, the place never used before, you know, just you know, jungles.
Just open land.
Open land and then just totally, completely forests. And then when they got there, so they did many things. They even cutting, you know, forests, trees and try to make, you know, herds for, you know, living and that, so there been many years. They, you know, the all senior monks, they did wonderful things for the coming generations. And so after that, then they finally they made, you know, the replica of Tibetan that Depo monastery in the southern India, and thereby every year we are receiving over hundreds of, you know, the Tibetan refugee from, you know, Tibet and joining with this exile, you know, the refugee monastery, Depo Lhasa monastery.
Now, you are touring the United States, raising money for the monastery, and one of the things that you're doing here, this coming Saturday, December 27th at 7 o'clock at the James A. Little Theater, is performing Sacred Music, Sacred Dance, and that is an event that you, I guess, do year after year. Is that correct?
Yes. We are actually on the tour of FEM, you know, the Mystical Arts of Tibet tour,
right,
which was founded in 1989 in Atlanta, Georgia. So we actually in the state, we based in Atlanta, Georgia. And since then, a group of monks from our monastery are touring all through the United States and some other countries. And this is actually this particular group actually is the 11th, you know, the tour groups on the Mystical Arts of Tibet tour. And so every 1.5 years, so we're traveling all through the U.S., mainly in the universities, different colleges, different high school, elementary schools, different galleries, museums, different churches. And so here in Santa Fe, so we have been very honored and happy to sharing one of our, you know, the spiritual culture and traditions. For example, a sand painting that we have been making at the Serret Gallery here.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that too.
Yeah, and also we are having, you know, the performance, the sacred music, sacred dance, very ancient, not the performance that normal, I mean the common performance. This is something very much related with the spiritual spiritualities, and so, and also you see many different, you know, the costumes, very rich ancient Tibetan costumes.
So it's ancient different music and ancient dance, mm-hmm, and it's for world healing.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us more about the dance and the nature of the dance. Are you telling a story with the dance?
Yes, we are having, you know, the 9 different pieces on the performance, and the each pieces, you know, the announcer will, you know, make announcements what actually it is and what history behind it and what actually symbolizes. Even, you know, the costumes and, you know, the rituals items and so on and so forth, everything has, you know, going to be explained and then as, you know, the symbolisms and so on and so forth. While we're doing each pieces has, you know, different announcement, the announcement will be, you know, we're making.
Tell us an example of one of the pieces and the symbolism of it.
For example, like the dance of the Black Hat Masters. One of the very ancient...
The dance of the what?
Black Hat Masters.
Black Hat Monsters.
Masters.
Oh, Masters, okay.
Yeah, the Black Hat Masters, we call the Shana Karcham. And one of the very ancient, you know, the Tibetan, you know, the performance. As the dance of the Black Hat Masters, so two dancers will dance on the stage, you know, they're wearing very rich costumes, having many different symbolism. For example, like at apron of their, you know, the costume, it wears with the face of the wrathful spirit, and which symbolizes, you know, the how intense compassion and is required to complete the wall of, you know, the path of healing and so on and so forth. And also, you know, that dancer also, you know, the carrying with the mystic daggers. One hand, you know, they carry mystic daggers, and other hands they carry the human skull cup, and the mystic dagger, which symbolizes the wisdoms penetrating the real natural being, and our reality of all things and events, and then other hands carrying with the human skull cup, which symbolizes the impermanence nature of all existence. So that's how that itself is very the dance of the Black Hat Master itself, symbolizes when there are need for elimination of the negativities, negative hindrances, and so on and so forth. So they perform as an elimination of all the negativities and negative, the energies, and so on and so forth.
So does the performance actually help eliminate the negativities?
This traditionally speaking, this kind of performance is performed on the the eve of the new year, as a way to the eliminating that one might have accumulated throughout this old year.
So all the people sitting in the audience of the James A. Little Theater,
yes,
and their negativity,
and then it depends on how people look at that performances, and how people they connect with the performance, pieces, and it depends on how the mental attitude, and so we believe that even as the dancing itself is eliminating the external negativities, hindrances, obstacles, and then the internal level also.
So all of this is happening at the James A. Little Theater on Saturday, December 27th at 7 in the evening. Sacred music and sacred dance for world healing, and with very elaborate traditional costumes and traditional Tibetan instruments, and chanting.
Chanting, yes.
Now tell us about the kind of chanting. It's a sound that most of us do not hear every day.
While we're chanting, we do have this chant master, wonderful, the chant master.
Who's with us here at the table right now?
Yeah, right now, Mr. The Venerable the Ngawang Jimba, and also the Geshe Tsubla Gyatso, who has been very, wonderful for the chanting. As far as we call the chanting, we call the Dzogke in Tibetan, which means the complete voice. And in West, it is known as the multiphonic chanting, because the chant master can make three notes at a time. So that's essentially known in the West as overtone singing, or the tonal chanting, or the multiphonic chanting.
Right.
So while we're doing the performance, and some pieces are the chanting pieces, so where the monks are they're chanting on the different verses for the generation of compassion and loving kindness, and some the pieces also chanting on the purifications of the environments, and also its inhabitants of environments. So there are many the different pieces of the chanting too.
Could we hear some of the chanting? Would
sure.
you like to sing for us?
Sure, definitely.
Oh.
and that was chanting of the monks of the Drepung Losaling Monastery, who are here visiting us in Santa Fe and will be performing this along with music and dance, including Tibetan instruments, as well as dances and costumes on Saturday, the 27th of December. Now, in that chant that we just heard, was that words?
Yes, it's a chanting that we call, you know, the invocation of forces of goodness.
So and, what were the words they were saying?
Yeah, the Malu Semjan, you know, Malu Semjan. There's a, you know, the stanza, you know, the verses that, the meaning, which means actually the invocation of forces of goodness. So the invoking, so all, you know, the falsest nature of, you know, the enlightened being and so on and so forth. So invoking, those, enlightened being and the deities, so in order to receive the blessing and the healing energies and so on and so forth. So whenever we start, we have to start from this, you know, the verse is called the invocation of forces of goodness, and then thereby starting, you know, the any, you know, the prayers and activities, you know.
Do you do that one every day?
Yes, they have, you know, the ones on, you know, the individual practices, individual prayers, as we have, you know, the committed, you know, the vows, taking vows as a daily basis, you know, one do also the, you know, the daily prayers and the meditations.
So you also do a sand mandala, and probably many of our listeners have seen this, and it's the application of almost grain by grain of sand,
yes,
to make a beautiful, elaborate, impermanent work of art.
Yes, baby. Yeah, this, you know, here we are having very special sand painting this time. And we have been here, I mean, the monks from Drepung Losaling, you know, they have been, you know, they're very honored in the Santa Fe. Yeah, this is not the first time coming on in the Santa Fe. But this time here, this 11th group, you know, the monks from Drepung Losaling Monastery have been very honored and happy to sharing the sand painting here. And this, that sand painting, the mandala we called, and special mandala for the special the time of, you know, the need of, you know, the need for the people in Santa Fe and all over United States and in the world. So this, the mandala known as the mandala of the green Taras.
The green Taras.
Green Taras. And whose specific energy is for good health and long life, and also the good wealth for this, you know, the economic crisis and economic, you know, the difficulties in these days in all over the world. So we have decided, you know, making the mandala of the green Taras.
And so that is happening every day at Surrett & Sons, which is at 121 Sandoval Street here in Santa Fe. And you do a chanting from 4:30 to 5. It closes at 5 each afternoon, but you do a chanting of this same kind of chant that we just heard?
Yeah, we do. This is also the one example, one piece of the chanting. And also we do the high pitch, you know, the high pitch chanting.
Oh, okay.
So this is what we call the low pitch chanting.
Right.
Also in Tibetan known as a Dzogchen. And then there's others, you know, the chanting, including, you know, the high pitch and also silent meditation at the same time we're doing as a conclusion parts of, you know, the everyday activities,
and
making
so,
sand painting
right.
From 4:30 to 5, like 30 minutes.
And people can sit there and meditate listen.
Yes, definitely. People are welcome to be joining with the monks and doing chanting and the meditation together for 30 minutes. That, you know, starts from 4:30 to 5 p.m.
And so I've seen many times people doing this sand painting with little tiny tools in which the beautiful colored sand goes. Now, how do you learn? What is your training like to do that? Do you have to be an artist by nature?
Yeah, definitely. You know, this kind of training is only, you know, the given to one becomes, you know, the senior monks of the monasteries. And this is actually the highest levels of the practices, that the mandala itself, you know, belongs to the highest teaching. And it's, you know, the very ancient, you know, the spiritual arts, you know, over 2,000 years before. And everything, as you know, they totally, you know, they observe in text. And there is no individual freedom for the artist, monk. And each and everything, you know, they strictly observe in text and explain in text. Since our monks, you know, they got, you know, 5 to 7 years training for whole process, For example, as for the process of the training, first one has to memorize that root text. So over, you know, 100 pages it has. So one has to memorize. And then
so you're memorizing a 100-page text word for word.
Word by word.
Okay.
And then after memorizing that text, so one has to receive the teaching from the masters. So what actually carries the meaning of, you know, each words. And then the practical training on the boat, on the table, with the metal funnel or the chakpur in Tibetan, with very fine, you know, fragile, you know, the delicate sand. And that actually sand itself is, you know, the white marble stone, and we crush in dyeing with the vegetable color, you know, the color powders, and then putting some mix with some precious stones for different colors. And so we're making, you know, as precious as possible, because while we're making mandala sand paintings, so we're making offering to the all the lineage of the masters and enlightened being and so in order to receive the blessing and healing energies. So that's how the main, you know, the three step to, you know, that the process of the training, you know, the memorization of the text and the receiving teaching and then the practical training on the board with the metal funnel and the sand.
And also they never make a mistake.
While they are in the process of training, so they do.
Yeah.
But on the tour, it's almost impossible. You know, so far we haven't had, you know, that the mistake, and that's because it is really, you know, the 5 to 7 years long, you know, the full training they got through the very, you know, the experienced master at the monastic university in South India.
Are you one of the artists?
I'm actually the spokesperson for the tour.
Okay.
And I'm not, you know, the making sand painting. I'm mostly, you know, the talking. I mean,
the translator.
As a spokesperson. I'm normally called the talking monk. I just, whenever, you know, the press people and the friends and these other people, when they have questions, and I'm the one who, you know, try to give answers for their questions and also explaining.
Right. Mm-hmm. Now, when you are in the monastery the rest of the year, what is your day like? What do you do when you get up in the morning, and how does it go from there?
As for our monastic university, Depung Losling Monastic Universities, normally we have two prayer sessions, and the morning prayer sessions and the evening prayer sessions. As for the morning prayer sessions, it starts from 5:30 to 7:30. At the, you know, the all monks come together, and we normally join, you know, the prayer sessions. All monks come together at the main assembly hall from 5:30 to 7:30, and breakfast also served in, you know, the main chanting hall. And after that, and then 7:30 to 9 a.m. So we call the period for the memorization period, you know, the memorization time. So every student, you know, student monks got their lessons, their texts that one has to memorize. So that we normally call the 7:30 to 9. So we call, you know, the memorization period. And from 9 to 11:30, so we do have two debate sessions in a day, two prayer sessions and two debate sessions. And that first debate session starts from 9 a.m. to 11:30. So all the student monks come together in the debate courtyard, and then making debate on Buddhist philosophies within one's own, you know, the classmates. And then 11:30 to 12 or 12:30, so, you know, the lunch break. And then
I was going to say, I hope you eat.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so the 12:30 to 2, so they normally, you know, the younger, the you know, the new, you know, the student, they do, you know, the period for the calligraphy, Tibetan calligraphy practices, and you know, the training. And then other monks go, you know, their classes, took their classes, and also so 4:30 around, you know, 4:30 to 5:30, you know, the lunch, I mean the dinner break. And then 5:30 to 7, we have the recitation period. So whatever we have memorized in the morning,
you recite.
We have to recite over and over and repeatedly. Otherwise,
wow,
we forget. So that's how we repeat. I mean the repetition, I mean recitation periods from, you know, 7:30 to 7, and then 7 to, you know, the 9 p.m. we have an evening, you know, the prayer sessions which is, you know, the held at the main, you know, the debate courtyard. All the monks come together for the evening prayer sessions, 7 p.m. to, you know, the 9 p.m. And then after 9 p.m. to 11:30 or 12:30 or sometimes 1:30 a.m. for the debating, you know, the debate session.
So a lot of debating as well as
In our monastic universities, we do have a, you know, the monks, student monks mostly spending their time on the debate because of the analyzing the each and every meaning of the each and every words of the Buddhas and the commentators and the scholars of Indian scholars and Tibetan scholars and so on and so forth. So debate is something, the main, you know, the factors in order to, you know, the get, you know, the real, the ultimate meaning of the teaching.
Now, you call it a university. Do the students graduate and go somewhere else, or do they stay in the Drepung Losaling Monastery for their lives?
We're using, I mean, the monastic universities, and it's not, I mean, the same as the universities and colleges in this Western world.
Yeah, here you graduate and you go away.
Yeah, go away, and it's not totally, it's totally different, I think. Because since, you know, becoming monk is not for the certain period of time. So while you're taking the vows to be a monk, so with that vows should be for the lifelong. So there's all one's life and one's time and one's life and one's all energy is dedicated for these spiritual practices. So in order to practice those, the meaning of the teaching and so on and so forth, the first one has to study. So that's how our monastic university has established some kind of, you know, giving degree as to have a, you know, to give, you know, the encouragement, you know, the, you know, the promoting each class one after, you know, each, you know, the year. So that's how once we finish the studies, so one has to still, you know, there's no, you know, the limitation of studies. So the whole life is for studies and practices and so on and so forth.
So, Marsha Keegan has been sitting here very quietly. You are one of the forces behind all of this activity here in Santa Fe, including organizing the monks' tour and many of their activities. And also, they are giving house blessings, and they can call you. What's the house blessing about?
Well, a house blessing is they go to a house and bless it, and it's quite historic and wonderful for everybody that experiences it. They have their friends over. And one of the processes is they have petals, yellow and red petals, a bowl of red petals that they throw as they're doing their prayers. And they go into each room and throw this as part of the ritual. And it's a wonderful blessing. And people have really had called for different reasons, that they have ghosts in their house, or they want to just have a better energy in their house. And they've all said that it's been very helpful.
Yeah, sometimes new house.
New house, yes, when they first come to a new house.
That's a very Tibetan traditionally. You know, when there's new house going, having, you know, new house.
That's being built.
It's being built, you know, then there is also a special prayer for the new house, bringing more auspiciousness, you know, that the prayers intended for the, you know, bringing more auspiciousness in new house, and the prosperity, happiness, and there's old house that need to be, you know, the clean, you know, the cleansing through the spiritual practice, I mean the spiritual prayers, I mean the prayers and the meditations and sounds and music and so on and so forth, and there's also certain prayers that one has to do accordingly to the situation, I mean sometimes, you know, the external kind of the interferences, negative energies keep, you know, the going on once, you know, the environment. So that's that kind of situation that we have to do, choose a certain, you know, the prayers has to be done.
We're just about out of time, but I just wanted to mention that Marsha Keegan is the publisher of Clear Light Books, which as of recently has a bookstore, which is right next to
Open Hands.
Thank you, Open Hands store. And they are having all sorts of sales. They're open from Tuesday through Saturday from 10 to 4 at 851 West San Mateo. And the number over there is 424-9090. And if anybody is interested in a house blessing, what is the number? Oh, here's the number that they should call, 989-9590.
And I think that we forgot to say that the dismantling of the mandala is
right.
New Year's Eve.
Thank
you. It's a wonderful way to bring in the new year.
Yes, indeed. So, and that will be at Surrett & Sons, which is 121 Sandoval Street here in Santa Fe. And the ceremony of the dismantling is from 9:30 in the evening until 1 in the morning. And all this incredible work gets swept away in one stroke of the broom.
And everyone's given a little bit of sand to take home as a blessing.
That's right.
Yes, definitely. We have distributed the blessing to everyone.
Well, I want to thank you all so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you for
inviting
us.
And thank you, Marcia.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be back in a moment. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Tony Stromberg. He is a photographer, and his new book is The Forgotten Horses. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte. Thank you.
It's great to have you back. You were here a couple of years ago with your last book.
Yeah, about 3 years, I think. Uh-huh.
And so this is it's basically continuing in this practice that you have of photographing horses. How did you start doing that?
Horses in general?
Horses in general.
Uh, I started doing commercial work. I was a commercial photographer, advertising photographer in San Francisco for quite a few years. And at one point, I had a client who kind of disappeared on weekends, and I asked her at one point where she went, and she said she had a horse and had a completely different life, and invited me out to just come visit one weekend. And I went out and took a camera and started to photograph, and realized that I just, even though horses had not been in my life up to that point whatsoever, there was something I really loved about that day and being around horses, you know, partly their size.
So you hadn't grown up with them or any of that?
No, huh? Not at all.
And so here you are, and it just became a passion for you to the point where you actually left your lucrative commercial photography career.
Yeah. Eventually. It took a little. It was a long transition. But.
So in the book, which has a very nice foreword by Robert Redford, you have an introduction in which you talk about the ways in which, as urban people, we're not really fulfilled by our lives, and reconnecting to animals fills something that we're all hungry for.
I think so. I think at the time I was trying really hard to make myself a city boy, and it became apparent the more I spent time with horses that I really loved it. I was living at the time in the south of Market area of San Francisco, which is very industrial, lots of concrete, not much growing organically. So it kind of became a little bit of almost like a spiritual place for me. I was doing a lot of work at the time with different therapists and kind of going through my own dark night of the soul, so to speak. And I realized that the time I was spending with horses up there was very sacred to me, and I was learning so much about myself through my relationship with the horses and as well as other animals. It kind of became my church in a funny sort of way.
Looking through the book at these incredibly beautiful and moving and, I guess you would say, kind of spiritual pictures of horses, the thing that's so striking over and over is the sense that we're all not necessarily the same species, but we're all the same life force, and there's an understanding that we have with one another, both interspecies, and what we see, the way that they relate to each other, is so similar in the ways that we relate to each other.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're interdependent, and I think that's what they teach us, is interdependence. There's a great little book I read again last week called Kinship with All Life by a guy named J. Allen Boone, and he talks about his relationship with a dog in particular, that how he learns, or maybe gets reminded is a better way, about how we are all interrelated. And what I think what's happened in this culture is we've gotten so focused on competition and being better than the other or having more, or that we've kind of lost touch with each other in a lot of ways. And also there's been this huge shift towards living in an urban environment for people. Not that many people live rurally anymore, so they've lost touch with the earth, you know, with plants, with animals, and all that stuff that kind of brings us together.
And for reasons that are very understandable, because until very recently, that was a very rough life.
It was a hard life, yeah, but I think also a nourishing life. You know, I know a lot of friends who work corporate jobs, long hours, 10, 12, 14 hours a day, and they don't like them particularly. And it's almost like they're waiting for the day when they can kind of cash in on their stocks and leave and actually begin their life. And I also have friends who've done the opposite. They've kind of escaped that life, gone out into the country, started a farm, you know, raise animals, and they seem infinitely happier.
We're talking to Tony Stromberg. His new book is The Forgotten Horses, and it's mostly a book of photography. But who are these horses that you're photographing?
Basically, they're the horses across the country that were discarded for one reason or another. Most of them, the seed for this book got planted when some of the horses in my first book, I realized, were not here anymore. They had been euthanized for what I thought were some not very good reasons.
What were some of those not very good reasons?
Slight lameness, not being rideable in a competitive form anymore.
So a racehorse would be killed when it couldn't race anymore?
Uh-huh. Oftentimes they're sent off to slaughter.
It's the same thing with dogs, same thing with greyhounds.
Yeah. Many dogs, you know. You know, you've heard a lot about these puppy mills,
yeah.
You know, through the Humane Society and all that. Similar thing. You know, there's a market, and the Santa Fe is a little unique in that sense, that people are very much dog-oriented, cat-oriented, you know, they're animal people, and they advocate that. But in most cities of the country, I think, there's a lot of animals, I mean, a surprising number that just don't make it. So with the horses, I think when I realized a couple of the horses I'd befriended earlier were not there anymore, it planted a seed. And I realized at one point this book had to be done not about, you know, flashy breeds or, you know, expensive horses or race horses or anything like that, but of all the forgotten horses and all the abandoned horses in the country. And it was kind of my way, I guess, of making a statement about, you know, how we've kind of deviated as a culture a little bit. You know, if something isn't just right or just perfect, we tend to dispose of it and get a new one. So
now, in some ways, the horses are forgotten, but from another point of view, they're very much remembered by the organizations, some of whom you talk about, who save horses.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about some of those.
Most of the ones I visited in the book were privately run, nonprofit. A lot of them started, you know, very common story. A lot of them started as a one person or a couple who ended up adopting a horse
that
by
would
default.
Otherwise have been, yeah.
Yeah, and no one else was taking it, and they felt an obligation to take it on, make it part of the family. And, you know, a lot of times once you start doing that, you get a reputation. So, you know, along comes the next second horse or the
right.
third, or one gets dropped off in the middle of the night.
Right.
All of a sudden you find yourself the founder and owner of a horse sanctuary. So.
And so you talked about Rolling, is it Rolling Dog Ranch?
Rolling Dog, uh-huh, up in Montana, is an interesting one. It was a couple, and they started out taking in a blind horse, not knowing much about it, and through that process, educating themselves about blind horses and all these different optical diseases and where they come from and how to treat them and how to care for a blind horse. I mean, you've got a 1,000-pound-plus animal that can't see. It's challenging. They have ultimately become specialists. And in fact, when I was there, they had gotten a call from some lady in Belgium who had a blind horse and was seeking advice. And I think they have about 45 or 50
wow.
now.
All blind horses.
All completely blind.
And yeah. they all interacting with each other. Have yeah. they developed a blind horse culture of interdependence?
You know, they've got them separated into pairs, and then their pastures are kind of squared off, so each pair has a big pasture of their own. And they move together almost like, you know, koi fish, you know. They
right.
they sense each other, and
right.
they move like this, almost like a dance. And it was interesting for me to go there because I thought, what's it going to be like to be around horses that don't have eyes? It's, you know, like the windows to the soul. And I was surprised to find that there was just as much presence there, if not more so, because of that. And it was a powerful experience for me.
So there's also a group called Return to Freedom.
Uh-huh, in California. That was founded by a woman named Netta DiMeo. Basically, her mission was to take a lot of the wild horses of the country that were being put in through the adoption program or you know, slaughtered, and create a home for them, permanent home for them, also with the intention of really keeping specific bloodlines intact from specific herd areas throughout the country. A lot of these were original Spanish descendant horses of a particular type. The Chis managed to keep them, their bloodlines intact, and let them live out on the sanctuary in their original family bands, stallions, mares, and babies, which is really unusual. Most people separate them. The stallions from the mares, from their offspring, never to be seen again. So it's
right.
one of the few in the country that actually do that.
The photographs yeah. in the book, I mean, one can see that combination of technical virtuosity, which I guess you developed as a commercial photographer, and this tremendous love that you have and kind of inspiration that you have from the horses.
Mm-hmm.
What is a photographic session like for you when you go out among the horses?
You know, someone emailed me the other day and they said, so, actually it was an interview. I had to type and they said, can you tell us about what you do with wild horses? What is the most important thing? And what kind of equipment do you use? And I said, well, I get asked this question a lot, and I think people think that it's the equipment that takes the pictures. It's not. It's the relationship. When I started photographing horses, I'd go out and try and capture a shot, and nothing was happening. It wasn't working. And
capture is an interesting metaphor.
Yeah. And I spent years doing that commercially, actually directing a shoot down to the most infinite little detail as far as lighting and creating it happen, you know, making it happen. I realized this was on the other end of the spectrum, that with a horse, with anybody, you know, that would apply to humans as well. The relationship has to be first. That has to be established. So when I go out, if I'm photographing a wild horse, I have to be in their environment, on that terrain. I have to be respectful of that. I have to be invited into their world. So a lot of it is just patience and waiting and trying to communicate to them that I'm not a threat, that I'm wanting to be part of the family, so to speak. So it's kind of this very intricate dance that you do. And it takes a while to establish that. You know, a lot of it means getting really quiet and really listening and paying attention to what they're telling you, you know, with body language and movement. And then kind of evolving into the shot.
Are you always walking, or are you ever on a horse yourself?
Usually walking, yeah. Horses are, I don't know, it's just not very practical to haul a horse around, especially in places like that. So.
Right. The horses are in your book are so beautiful, and this is probably a ridiculous question, but do they know how beautiful they are?
I don't know. I don't know. That's a good question. I don't think they don't think in the same sense that humans do.
No, I know. You and know? I mean, domesticated animals are sort of on a funny borderline that way, because I think all three of my dogs know how cute they are, and they know how cute I think they are, and they use that, and they're manipulative with it. But these are much freer and wilder beings that, that you're photographing.
I don't think they have a sense of beauty or not beauty. I think they just are. They just are who they are. You know, no, there's no concept.
When you take the photograph, what we see in the book often, for example, even the cover shot, is a kind of, what would you call it, yellow-brown, sepia-toned photograph. Mm-hmm. How different is the result from what you see when you're out there? In other words, no landscape is that color exactly.
This one was pretty close, actually.
Really?
It depends. You know, I'll do a lot after the fact. I used to do a lot of darkroom work. Now most of it's done electronically on the computer.
Right.
Where, you know, I'll play with a shot. I'll try it in black and white. I'll try it in color. I'll try toning it brown or sepia, and just to see where its strength comes out. Doesn't always work, but I tend to gravitate towards warm tones. So you'll see a lot of that in my work. You know, the browns, the yellows, reds. You know, in that spectrum.
What do you hope to accomplish? I mean, obviously, there's a tremendous fulfillment for you in doing this work, but is it also part of a larger animal welfare, horse welfare movement?
I think so. I don't know if you've tracked the news lately, but there's been kind of a big political debate regarding the Bureau of Land Management lately. They announced several months ago that they've had an adoption program going for years where they've taken wild horses off public lands, put them through an adoption program, and tried to adopt them out. What's happened is most of them have ended up in holding pens at various parts of the country, not being adopted out, and the numbers have accumulated up to about 33,000. And they made an announcement a few months ago that because of lack of funding, they were going to euthanize all 33,000. So it basically negates the entire program. It's a very controversial subject, because a lot of people feel that if the herds were properly managed on public lands, they don't need to go through an adoption program. They don't need to be gathered and taken off public lands in the first place.
How do they survive on public lands?
Very difficult. If you look at the maps, most what they call herd management areas, for instance, the one in Nevada, one of the larger ones, is very adjacent to the Naval Gunnery Range and directly above the nuclear waste disposal site. So the land that they're allocated, and, you know, it's funny because it kind of goes back to the Native American tradition. You know, the land that the government allocates to them is probably the least usable of any land in the country. Wild horses don't generate an income, so why give them valuable land? In a way, they're kind of swept under the rug a little bit.
Right, right. What's going to happen to those 33,000 horses? I mean, are they goners?
Actually, there's a woman that stepped forward last couple of weeks named Madeline Pickens, who was a wife of a Texas billionaire named T. Boone Pickens.
Right.
Apparently, she and he, and ironically, he made a lot of his money through oil, a lot of it being drilled on public lands. So, you know, there's a funny little twist there.
Goes around, right.
But I guess she and he were responsible for airlifting a lot of the animals during Hurricane Katrina out of
New Orleans,
yeah. So she's very much an animal advocate, very active in those figures. And she's made a commitment to take all 33,000 horses, buy roughly 1 million acres of public, you know, and turn it into a wild horse sanctuary, which I think is incredible. In fact, I'd love to contact her and actually make a book out of that process.
Is that your next project, do you think?
I might. You know, we'll see if she responds. I don't know the politics of it all. I don't know what her intentions are after that point or how she's going to manage it all. But, you know, I think it's at least somebody stepping forward and saying, I'm going to do something about this. And somebody that has the resources to do it, not just, you know, the guy down the street who took in one horse. So I think it's setting a trend. You know, I think we're seeing this big shift right now. And, you know, once somebody of that stature does something like that, I think we'll start to see other people follow.
Tony Stromberg is a photographer, and his new book is The Forgotten Horses. You were here not too long ago at Garcia Street Books. The book is available there?
It is available there, and they do have many left. We did a book signing about 2 weeks ago. It was very, very successful and a lot of fun, and they are still available. So, yeah, that would be the place to go.
Well, I want to thank you so much for spending the time with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Brian Highhill for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, The Colors of Jazz. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.